This is The Guardian.
Enjoying this podcast? Then we think you might love the audio long read, the podcast of The Guardian Long Read, with episodes about caffeine addiction, the secret life of saints, and Britain's strangest pub chain. The Long Read offers great stories and big ideas. Follow the audio long read wherever you get your podcasts.
Keir Starmer is suddenly treading a very fine line between the EU and an increasingly unhinged Donald Trump.
The US will take over the Gaza Strip, and we will do a job with it too.
This week, the Prime Minister headed to Brussels to try and reset Brexit. But as the US President says he wants to take over Gaza and threatens Europe with eye-watering tariffs, how much longer can Starmer avoid picking a side?
It's really important that we work with both and we don't see it as an either-or.
I'm John Harris and you're listening to Politics Weekly UK for The Guardian. Joining me is The Guardian columnist Gabby Hinsliff. Hello, Gabby.
Hello.
If it's even possible anymore, Donald Trump left people stunned after saying that the US would take over Gaza and own it, and that Palestinians would have to leave and resettle in Egypt and Jordan.
The US will take over the Gaza Strip, and we will do a job with it too. We'll own it and be responsible for dismantling all of the dangerous unexploded bombs and other weapons on the site, level the site and get rid of the destroyed buildings, level it out, create an economic development that will supply unlimited numbers of jobs and housing for the people of the area.
By effectively endorsing the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, the US president's latest press conference has seemed to make Keir Starmer's distinctly softly approach to Trump and his administration even more untenable. Gabby, we're recording this on Wednesday afternoon after Trump's pronouncements about Gaza, which obviously have this sort of geopolitical element. Also, let's be honest, tinged with the sense of him as the sort of eternal real estate salesman talking about how he thinks Gaza could be turned into the new Riviera and all of that, which makes them even worse. Just give us your sense of how the UK government has responded.
I actually think probably Starmer handled this one quite well. I mean, he responded in the same way as literally every other, you know, sane government on the face of the earth has responded by saying, obviously, Palestinians have to have the right to come home. But he did hit a more emotional register about it. He talked about how moved he'd felt by seeing Gazans coming home to where their homes used to be, you know, where there's just a pile of rubble left.
From the last few weeks, two images fixed in my mind. The first is the image of Emily Damari reunited with her mother, which I found extremely moving. The second was the image of thousands of Palestinians walking, literally walking through the rubble to try to find their homes and their communities in Gaza. They must be allowed home. They must be allowed to rebuild. And we should be with them in that rebuild on the way to a two-state solution.
You know, there is a sort of political reality about it, but there's also an emotional reality about it. In a way, if you're going to, and he always was going to hit a point where Trump was going to do something that we were going to have to condemn, in a way, this one, because the entire world is condemning it, it's not like we stand out by doing so.
Has he condemned it, though, as such? Or he sort of condemned it by implication, right?
Yeah.
So there's still this sense, watching what Starmer says, of feeling the absence of any sort of moral or condemnatory tone about how awful these comments are.
Do you want him to say?
I don't know what I want him to say.
You should resign.
I know what I think, and I'm sure I know what you think as well, and most people listening to this think, right? And perhaps necessarily because of Starmer and the position that he's in, he can't say any of that stuff.
I think what you want him to say is you're an abjectly awful human being who should, you know, immediately leave the White House.
This is an untenable and fairly outrageous and provocative suggestion
but
that no one should take seriously.
You know, what we need to know is, do you agree with this or not? And we've got not, and we've got a reason why not. And that seems to me sort of coded within diplomatic language. That seems to me about what I would have expected. And, you know, different things may be said behind the scenes, who knows? I don't think at this point cavilling about, you know, whether it was strong enough language or not is necessarily the biggest priority right now. The biggest priority right now feels to me like, how do you prevent this exploding right the way across the Middle East? How do you get through even to an American regime that thinks this is fine? You were not dealing with the old Trump, you know, where you would sort of put calls into the more sane bits of his administration and see if someone, you know, and somehow between them, they would restrain the president. You know, that's not the game we're in anymore. We're in a game where he can say this and the Israelis can say, ooh, sounds great to me. What exactly are you going to do about it, rest of the world?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, God knows what it's like being in government at a point like this. Because as an observer, you know, vaguely sort of professional observer, my sense all the time is having to remind myself that Trump is serious, right? There's nothing facetious or funny about this. When he says he wants the USA to take Greenland off Denmark, he means it. When he says that he thinks Canada ought to be the 51st state of the USA, he means it. And equally, he means that the USA should take over Gaza and it would be a great site for prime real estate, right? And God knows how you handle that if you're in a position of power, as Keir Starmer is.
I think he means it in the moment. I mean, there's still something open about how far he'll actually go to pursue some of the things he's saying. And we've seen that with, you know, the tariff war earlier this week, where there's lots of threats and then eventually he backs off. And, you know, so we don't quite know how much he would see any of it through. But you're right, you can't afford to treat any of this as a joke, because what if it isn't? Even if he isn't serious, some of these things have consequences. You know, other countries will respond in the Middle East to what Trump has said, whether or not he definitely meant it. I think our mistake with Trump this time round, and it's something that as journalists you instinctively do, is trying to make sense of the chaos when actually maybe it's the chaos that is the sense. It's like we're trying to see a clever strategy. Oh, maybe he says this but really means this, or maybe he does this to throw people off. Or maybe what we're actually dealing with is just someone's stream of consciousness. He's literally saying what's in his head.
Yeah, although the other element of it is strategic in as much as it's a sort of glorified extortion. So in other words, you make these threats because you want something in return, and then you'll dial down the threats. That's the only logic that I can see, right? I mean, that certainly applies to his approach to tariffs, it seems. And I dare say it applies to maybe what he said about Greenland and Canada as well. Again, that's sort of unprecedented in modern international relations, the idea that the world's preeminent superpower just goes around threatening people to get what it wants.
Tariffs are used as kind of leverage. They're a kind of win-win in his mind. You know, either you threaten a tariff and you impose it and then you make money from it, or you threaten a tariff because someone won't do what you want and then they will do what you want. So bingo, you know, you never have to impose the tariff and you've won the argument. And in that sense, you know, the argument that we've had this week about, oh, could the UK escape tariffs? I mean, no, everyone's going to have their turn in the spotlight and it's going to be his go-to threat if he wants something from you that you don't want to give. So the only way to avoid them is to either have nothing the US wants or just do what he wants whenever he asks. But the interesting thing, I mean, America has kind of enforced its will on the world until now using military might. It's a military superpower. Trump was really resistant in his first term to actually using military force, you know, threaten it, but he would never actually use it. And actually, America withdrew in a military sense during that period. And it's like he wants to use economic firepower instead. And that's what he said with Canada. Yeah. I would never invade them. I'll just kind of tariff them into doing what I want. It's as if he sees the whole world like a monopoly board, that, you know, your solution to everything is to either build a hotel on it, which appears to be a solution to the Middle East peace process, or just kind of grab as many assets as you can and stop other people getting them. And it's interesting how much his foreign policy so far seems to have been determined where he sees there are natural resources. So, you know, Greenland's got loads of oil and it's got deposits that he wants.
To cut Starmer some slack, so far, right, and obviously we're only weeks into the new Trump administration, but nonetheless, he's managed to simultaneously, it seems, appease Donald Trump and the EU pretty well as being the first prime minister invited to the EU Council in 5 years. He's been singled out by Trump as doing a good job, right? He's not in the Justin Trudeau position yet. Do you think that's a measure of Starmer's political skill?
We'll see how it lasts, I think. You know, we'll see whether that's a starting position after which it all goes south very quickly. But at the moment, you know, Starmer is playing essentially, it's like a three-dimensional game of chess, except at least two of the other people playing chess are three-year-olds who won't accept that there are rules about how the pieces move. So you've got, he's trying to play off the US on one side, and we've already discussed the issues there. He's trying to negotiate with his EU partners on the other side. They're the same players. And then you've got kind of the British public back home who are also not entirely accepting, shall we say, of the limitations placed.
So who are the 2 3-year-olds? I understand Donald Trump's a 3-year-old
the other one's us.
Chess,
but... the other one's all of us.
Oh, we're 3 years
old
as well.
We want the good bits out of a relationship with the EU, but not the bad bits. We
That's
want
good. Okay.
All the things that we, you know, we want, like better trade and access to all the perks we used to have of EU membership, but not any of the bits that we didn't want.
Do you think he's a better diplomat than a domestic politician? I think he probably is.
I think he's very well advised these days on foreign policy, better advised sometimes than he is on domestic policy, maybe. And interacting with the EU is very comfortable for him. As we all know, you know, before he went into politics, he was a lawyer. He was a human rights lawyer. He's cooperating constantly with the European courts. You know, Europe to him is a place where you go for resolution of disputes. It's the Supreme Court. It's the higher arbiter. It's where you go for justice when you don't get it at home. Other EU leaders operate in a way that he's very comfortable with. You know, Trump operates in a way that nobody is comfortable with. So we'll see how well he is able to manage that relationship.
Okay, we've cut Keir Starmer quite a lot of slack there, but let's rein a bit of it back in. Domestically, he is in trouble, it's fair to say, politically. Of course, it's early days in his administration and so on, but we know that his personal opinion ratings have plummeted. Poll after poll is now showing Nigel Farage's Reform UK surging. There was a poll came out this week showing them a percentage point ahead of Labour. A lot of what Labour is doing seems to be aimed at somehow sort of dialing down the threat of Reform UK. And we all know how central Labour's worries about Europe and the idea that if you tiptoe even too close to it, in Nigel Farage's view, he kicks off and voters notice it and all of that. It's a very delicate walk, Britain's relationship with the EU in that context. So in that sense, as he tries to position the UK closer to the EU, Starmer is likely to be in for a hell of a ride. How do you think he navigates that? It's really, really difficult. Already this week, we've seen lots and lots of headlines and noises off about the idea that he's getting far too close to Europe too quickly, and this is selling out Brexit, and we ought to be closer to Donald Trump and all of that. It's really difficult.
It is really difficult, but I actually think, I mean, there's a sort of golden window here where... actually, if you look at, and YouGov had some really useful polling out this week, just showing sort of where we are on all this stuff now. So, you know, if you ask people, do they want to be closer to the US or closer to Europe? By quite a strong margin, people want to be closer to Europe. It's almost half of all voters, but it's even 1 in 5 Reform voters would rather be closer to Europe to the US. So actually, when Nigel Farage starts arguing about let's do a trade deal with the US, that's not a popular position, I think, because Trump isn't very popular still here. And also because I think the one thing people know about an American trade deal is they think that will mean that we have to eat chlorine washed chicken and hormones.
Yeah, that's in the culture. Chlorinated chicken, I think you're right, is in the culture.
Europe feels like a better bet than that. So that is, you know, in his favour. I think the other finding from that poll was that only 11% of people judge Brexit to have been a success. That doesn't mean that people want to rejoin, but it does mean that people think this is a mess. It needs sorting out. And even Leavers think they don't necessarily blame themselves for voting Leave. They just think, well, it wasn't done properly by the Tories.
Yeah, but public opinion is stuck in a very British place, isn't it? In as much as most of us know that Brexit was a mistake and it's been bad for the economy and bad for Britain's position in the world, right? And we're aware that sort of in the eyes of our international allies and so on, Brexit is still what defines us. And yet all of us, or most of us, probably me included, we don't want to talk about it, which is a very British thing to do, right? And that makes life for politicians quite odd.
I think there's two things that come into that. One is the sort of exhaustion. It's like we don't want to talk about Brexit anymore from any perspective. But the other one is that kind of thing that Remainers had dinned into them that, well, you know, you lost, you get over it. You know, this is what people wanted. You tough, you know, suck it up. You know, a lot of people who were involved in the European movement last time around just don't want to go there again. But if you look what Farage, you know, the years that UKIP was in the wilderness, you know, plugging away with this cause that no one wanted, that people thought was ridiculous, that banging on about British sovereignty and pound signs on their lapels with the public opinion against them for 20 years, you know, they started from a position of public opinion being extremely hostile to leaving Europe and managed to latch on to something that people would bring people over to their side. And that's what the European movement has to do from the other side, essentially. Public opinion is essentially with them, and they've got to be able to capitalise on it rather better than they're doing at the moment.
Right, let's pause here for a minute. When we come back, we'll be talking about what Keir Starmer wants from the EU and whether he's likely to get it.
Work takes up most of your time. That's why you should use Stamps.com to save time with your mailing and shipping. Stamps.com will simplify your postage needs and add valuable time back into your workday, so you have flexibility to focus on more important things. Stamps.com can handle your mailing and shipping needs with rates up to 88% off UPS and USPS. Send invoices, checks, certified mail, packages, and anything else you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. If you sell online, connecting with every major marketplace and shopping cart is easy. Plus, you can schedule package pickups through their dashboard and automatically see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers with Stamps.com's Rate Advisor. Add more flexibility to your workday with Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com/program to sign up for a special offer. No contract, cancel anytime. That's Stamps.com/program.
Are you ready to feel the difference of truly hydrated skin? This winter, treat yourself to silky, smooth hydration with Osea's best-selling Undaria Algae Body Butter. Luxuriously rich, but never greasy, this TikTok-famous body butter is clinically tested to visibly firm skin and provide 72 hours of continuous hydration. Experience healthy, hydrated skin with clean, vegan skincare from Osea. Get 10% off your first order site-wide with code WINTER at OseaMalibu.com.
Welcome back. I'm joined now by Anand Menon, Professor of European Studies at King's College London, the Director of the UK in a Changing Europe. Most importantly, perhaps, Anand has been the go-to voice of objectivity and fact. Remember those? In the Brexit debate for longer than even he probably remembers. Hello, Anand.
Yeah, that was a lovely introduction. Thank you.
It's all true and factual. We have just passed 5 years since the UK finally left the European Union. And as we both know, as luck would have it for Keir Starmer, a few days after that anniversary, he headed to Brussels for an EU Council meeting with the 27 EU leaders. Now, it's fair to say that in the continually febrile atmosphere of British politics, our relationship with Europe is still a very sore point. In fact, Starmer's manoeuvrings this week have attracted no end of hostile headlines in the right-wing papers. But Starmer has been given the go-ahead for a big UK-EU summit in May this year as he tries to reset, that's the big word of the moment, our relationship with Europe. Let me briefly quote my Guardian colleague Raphael Baer from a column that's appeared this week. 5 years since leaving the European Union, he says, Britain is still negotiating Brexit. This time next year, Britain will still be negotiating Brexit. And so it goes on. This is going to be an ingrained feature of political life, probably for as long as everyone listening to this podcast lives. Now, the fact that EU leaders are coming to the UK for talks in May would seem to indicate that Keir Starmer's meetings this week went pretty well, Anand. Is that your reading? Tell us about this summit and where you think it's left things.
I mean, yes, on the surface, it did go well. I mean, the stories that came out of the dinner on Monday night was that Keir Starmer received a round of applause after he'd spoken to the assembled leaders, which is certainly something Theresa May never used to get. So in that sense, there's a warming, there's an appreciation on the EU side that here is a prime minister who genuinely wants closer relations. But, and there's always a but somewhere with Brexit, I think there's also been over the last 6 months a sort of creeping frustration on the EU side that we have a prime minister and a government that says all the right things, that does lots of nice handshaking and smiling and backslapping and talks about a reset. But 6 months in, they have absolutely no idea what, when it comes to the detail, the UK is really after. So I think there's a degree of impatience creeping in on the European side that our lot have been quite slow to say what they actually want.
You say that, but I've been reading things all week that claim to have the sort of definitive word on what Keir Starmer's asking for. The two sides want to make progress, we're told, on security cooperation, fishing rights, reducing checks on food exports. So there are sort of concrete specific things that it seems are on the agenda and in the public domain. But is that skating the surface, really, as far as Europe's concerned?
Yeah, I mean, I would call them vague, unspecific things. I mean, a security deal, what do they mean by a security deal? Do you mean just talking a bit more in a more institutionalized way with the EU? Do you mean participating in some of the schemes that the Commission has just launched to fund military procurement programs? They're very different things. On food exports and imports, this agricultural deal, there's a wide variety of agricultural deal you can have, okay? Some are more binding than others, some allow more access than others. And the EU's point is, yeah, we know you want to talk about agriculture, but what precisely do you have in mind? You know, talking to people on the EU side, there's a growing suspicion that the government doesn't know yet.
Is it that it doesn't know, or is it that once you get into specifics, you might unleash awful controversy? Because we both know how toxic this conversation is in large swathes of the British media. I mean, look at the front cover of the Daily Mail this week. What a time to be crawling back to the EU. There's this argument that because Trump is where he is, that this is a crazy time to be wanting to reset relations with Europe and we should put all our eggs in the American basket. Now, once you then get into this is what we want from the EU and you sort of set yourself up for what they would see as failure, you're in a difficult political place. So is that what the government's avoiding, do you think?
To an extent, I don't see why they can't confide it in their European interlocutors without going to the press. So it might be that they're playing a very cagey game. That's absolutely true. I mean, bear in mind, whatever this government does, chances are it's going to receive negative coverage in the Daily Mail and the other right-wing newspapers, okay? So in a way, you know, you want to avoid the recipe of saying, let's do nothing to avoid criticism. And they're early in their term in office, and it's the best time to act, probably. So I hope you're right. I hope that they're just playing it cagey and they have the details of what they want. But my suspicion is that's not true because the EU haven't been told anything. And on the EU side, one of the things this delay has meant is that the EU has had a bit of an opportunity to get its ducks in a row. They've said already, we want this youth mobility deal. They're saying the thing you want on touring artists, we're not going to be able to give you. And the EU, in a sense, has specified its asks a bit more than we have at this point.
It sounds like that might be because, and forgive me being blunt, what the British government is just a bit crap. By comparison,
I mean, you say crap, I say cautious, maybe. I think, you know, there are clearly divisions inside government about this. You saw this over the weekend with Yvette Cooper coming out and saying we really are not trying to negotiate a youth mobility deal. And there are others in government who think we need a youth mobility deal to open up the rest of stuff. So there's a conversation going on in government. There's a degree of caution on the part of the government because they worry about the threat that reform posed to them. So it is softly, but I think at this point, we're going to need to see some specifics and probably before the summit, because actually, I think one of the things that they're very keen on having on the EU side is what they call a deliverable. So the summit isn't just the launch of a negotiation, but they'd like to come out with something concrete to show that this actually means something real.
Yeah, that'd be a big nervous moment for the government, potentially. Let me ask you about how you think Donald Trump's return to the White House changes things between the UK and EU. I mean, there is this idea around in certain quarters that it gives the UK more leverage, that the UK can go back to its supposed classical role as the bridge between Europe and America and so on, particularly in the context of the fact that Trump is so difficult and he's making such threatening noises about the EU. Therefore, it's a good opportunity for the UK to somehow step in. Is there anything in that?
Possibly. I mean, obviously the great unknown is what Donald Trump is actually going to do. Okay, is he going to slap tariffs on the EU? Is he going to put tariffs on us? I think the real danger, and the Prime Minister very sensibly insisted that he would not have to choose between Europe and the US, the real danger is we're forced to choose. And it's a difficult choice because we have a very, very close and very, very significant military and intelligence sharing relationship with the US, and we have a very, very important economic relationship with the EU. If we find ourselves, for instance, in a situation where we are separating ourselves slightly from the EU in order to get ourselves a carve out of the tariffs, that I think will lead to some on the EU side saying, on the one hand, they want to reset and they want to prove they're European. On the other hand, they're on the wrong side of this transatlantic row. So why should we do business with them?
I wonder what that would look like. So in other words, what would the likely watershed point be when we had to kind of acknowledge reality and say, look, we are essentially a Europe-aligned power, and the person leading America or the regime leading America is so deranged that we're going to have to step to one side. It feels to me instinctively like that's possibly the way things are headed, particularly after his Gaza announcement, that there's some sort of inevitability to this. Or do you think I'm being naive?
I mean, it is utterly remarkable. I think we should get that out there, just watching what is going on in Washington at the moment. I mean, you couldn't have imagined it in your wildest dreams or nightmares. But I think there is still a big constituency here in the UK, amongst the military, in the intelligence services, who think that the close link with the United States is an existential issue for us, that is worth sacrificing virtually anything for, not only because it's good for our security, but because it gives us a certain heft in world politics that we wouldn't have without it. So I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that we say, okay, look, you're a bit odd. We're going to work with the Europeans a lot more now.
It'd be more than a bit odd. Do you know what I mean?
I stopped myself in mid-sentence.
Screamingly insane might be a more accurate projection. By the same token, as regards our relationship with Europe, if Donald Trump starts a trade war with the EU and Europe suffers very painful tariffs, that will strengthen the argument of people who say that the UK is best off leaving Europe at arm's length and allying itself with the US just to avoid that. That could be another really serious watershed moment, couldn't it?
And that could make an enormous difference, yes. But bear in mind, the European Union remains our largest trading partner. If they're suffering economically, it will have an impact on us because it will have an impact on the levels of trade between us. So it's not quite that straightforward, I don't think, that yet we can avoid tariffs with the United States and it will be a good thing for us to avoid tariffs with the United States. But if US policy imposes costs on the EU, that will have spillover effects on us.
There are lots of people who still think Brexit was a great idea, who say that Trump threatening the EU with tariffs proves the point that Brexit left the UK in a better position. I mean, they didn't know it at the time, but that's the way it's turned out.
Possibly, yeah. I mean, on the one hand, not being in the EU might mean we don't get these tariffs slapped on us. On the other hand, it means that if we do, we don't have the heft to credibly retaliate. The one thing the European Union has is the economic size to say to the Americans, okay, go ahead, do your worst, and we will retaliate. And of course, in Trump 1, what you had is the US threatening tariffs that in the end were averted, not least by the fact that the EU had a sort of credible threat of retaliation. So it could work to our advantage. One of the curious things about Brexit is that in the, almost 10 years since we voted to leave, the world has changed in ways that makes doing Brexit harder, not easier. Because Brexit, insofar as there was an economic vision, it was an economic vision of the UK as a trading powerhouse in a world of globalization on speed where all economies remained open and liberal. And of course, exactly the opposite has happened. As a result of COVID, the war in Ukraine, strained relations with China, globalization is being rowed back. And our two biggest trading partners, the US and the EU, have become more protectionist. They've been plowing money into subsidizing domestic economies. It suddenly feels a little bit lonelier out there being outside than it did.
Yeah. The danger then is in this world in which hitherto free trading blocks are shutting themselves off, that we end up in this very marginal, isolated position, right? Politically and economically. The other big change since 2016 is I think at that point, people who were sort of pro-EU would characterise the EU as a stable, settled political and economic bloc whose politics were very located in the sort of centre ground. Now, obviously, the European Union, its constituent countries, many of them aren't in that place anymore, right? Populism is running rampant across mainland Europe. We've seen the rise of the far right. Look at what's happening in Germany with the AfD and so on. Immigration is a huge issue in the EU in a way that it probably wasn't 9, 10, 11, 12 years ago. So that's another factor in all this, isn't it? That the EU itself feels sort of unstable in a way that it didn't 10 years ago.
To an extent. I mean, bear in mind, in 2016, the EU was still coming out of the Eurozone crisis, the refugee crisis. There weren't many people in 2015, 2016 saying, oh, that looks like a warm, comforting, stable place. It was going through ructions then. Also, I would just be a bit careful about language about, you know, the triumph of the far right in Europe. You've got centrist governments in France and Germany. You've got a left-wing government in Spain. You've got left-wing governments in the Scandinavian states. I think one of the curious things that comes out of that for me is a lot of those far-right parties, say in France or in Germany, some of them still are saying we should leave the European Union, but most of them are saying the European Union needs to be a lot weaker, needs to be a lot less bossy, we need to row back the role of the Commission. And for some centrist politics in the European Union, the idea of a Britain that has left the EU flourishing economically can only give grist to the mill to the populist right, who can point at us and say, you see, they left, they're doing fine. Why do we have to deal with all these rules? So there's a very strong political motive on their part not to do us any favours economically, which is slightly unfortunate at a moment when we're trying to negotiate an economic reset.
Right. I mean, certainly compared to the opening weeks of the Trump administration, notwithstanding all the difficulties I talked about, the EU still looks like the model of political stability and good sense. Anyway, here's a question. I suppose in the hearts of the kind of people who used to go on second referendum marches, there's a set of steps they would really like Britain and the EU to take, right? The Lib Dems are making a lot of noise at the moment about the fact they would like us, they say, to rejoin the customs union. There's still a lot of political talk about going back into the single market. And then, of course, there is this idea, it might be a fantasy, that somehow, sooner or later, we might rejoin the EU. You must be asked these questions all the time, but I wanted to take the opportunity to ask them to you again. Do you think they'd even have us back? I don't think they would. Is this just a distant fantasy?
I mean, firstly, I mean, I don't think you can join the customs union without being in the single market as well.
Right.
What is true is I don't think the European Union will do a full-scale renegotiation of our trading arrangements until they're relatively certain they'd stick, even through a change of government here.
How do you gauge that?
Well, I think they'd have to look like what they used to look like, which was there was a broad, if grudging, bipartisan consensus that we're in the European Union and that actually that's where we're going to stay. And I think one of the things to bear in mind about the EU at the moment is we are not amongst their top five and possibly 10 priorities at the moment. They've got a whole load of issues. As you were saying, they're dealing with the migration problem, with tricky domestic politics, with the likes of Viktor Orban in Hungary basically being on the wrong side of the war in Ukraine. They've got a whole list of problems that are more pressing than us. So we're not a priority is the first thing. And secondly, if they're going to sit down and waste a lot of time and effort in negotiating a new deal with us, they need to be certain in their own minds, insofar as they can be, that this will stick. And I just don't see them doing that when it looks likely that if there's a change of government at the next election, the Conservatives would just come in and rip up everything that Labour have negotiated.
That must colour their negotiations with Keir Starmer even now, mustn't it? The sense that, well, as they negotiate with him as the Prime Minister, there is a lot of sort of wider thinking about the state of British politics and where these attitudes to Europe are likely to go, right? So what does success look like for him, do you think, in the next couple of months?
Well, on this point specifically, navigating the negotiations to come, getting something on agriculture, getting anything you can get to make the economic relationship closer and building a more ambitious form of security cooperation without facing massive blowback or a huge surge for reform in the local elections, I think that would be a massive triumph.
It's a delicate walk, isn't it? Thank you for joining us, Anna.
My pleasure.
And thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please do like and subscribe wherever you listen and think about leaving us a review. It helps other people to find us and we really enjoy hearing your thoughts about the podcast. You can get in touch by emailing us at politicsweeklyuk@theguardian.com about today's episode or anything else you'd like us to discuss. For more on how Americans have reacted to President Trump's shocking comments about Gaza, don't miss tomorrow's episode of our sister podcast, Politics Weekly America. This episode of Politics Weekly UK was produced by Frankie Toby. The music is by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Zoe Hitch and Nicole Jackson.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Friedland from the Politics Weekly America podcast. Donald Trump has started his second term. It's going to be a turbulent period, and The Guardian will be here covering it all. We have no billionaire owners or shareholders pulling at the purse strings. So, if you can afford it, please do support us. Every contribution powers our independent journalism. Do click the link in the episode description.
This is The Guardian.
Hi, this is Freddie Wong from Dungeons & Daddies, and this episode is sponsored by Rocket Money.
Houston!
Blast off! Houston, we have a problem, and that's too many subscriptions that I don't know about because I like to put my credit card number into sites.
Just for the sheer thrill of it.
That's the fundamental problem of the internet and money, and Rocket Money is here to solve that. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that helps find and cancel your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. You can see all those subscriptions that you've accrued over a lifetime of putting your credit card in on the internet in one place. And if you don't want them, just cancel them. With a few taps, Rocket Money can help with that. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/cancelsubs. That's rocketmoney.com/cancelsubs, not submarines.